So last week, there's many more things that we could say about Daniel, but we've already talked a little bit about Daniel 12, and maybe we'll get back to that when we get back to Revelation, because Daniel 12 and Revelation really dovetail each other, and so I think we've already gone over that to some degree. So today I wanted to jump forward, and the timing's really good for where we're entering into Passion Week pretty soon, and Christ entering the temple, and so I wanted to start looking at the Olivet Discourse. So this is the longest answer that Jesus ever gave to a question, right? Is the Olivet Discourse, and we're going to look at just the very first few things that Jesus said was going to happen, and then we're going to go. Really, today is kind of more of a history on the destruction of the temple at Jerusalem. Now, people that have you ever heard the term preterism? So preterism is a view that the things that you read in Matthew 24, which is also recorded in Mark 13 and Luke 21, preterists believe that the things that Jesus talks about in that section were completely fulfilled when the Romans and Titus destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70, which we're going to talk about today. And they would even take what's in the book of Revelation with the seals and the trumpets and the vials, and they would say that that's all metaphorical descriptions of the things that happened at the time that Jerusalem was destroyed. And there's a lot of things in there. Like, we'll find that there were false prophets. There was a lot of things. The trees were wiped out and all the kinds of... But you would really have to take a very non-literal view of Revelation to come up with that particular view. So the thesis that I'm going to build is that when Christ is talking, it's a double prophecy, so to speak. Christ is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Especially the first part is going to happen just exactly as he described. But the events that happen in the destruction of Jerusalem foreshadow what's going to happen in the tribulation period before he comes. And this is very common in Scripture. For example, if you talk about the Exodus, right? Would you talk about the Exodus? Is that what happened when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, or is that what happened when Jesus came and freed us from slavery, right? Well, there's a historical event that paints a picture of something that happened in the future. And Matthew really draws on the whole Exodus experience and how that maps out the life of Christ. And so there's just an example where you have something that's literal history that actually is a foreshadowing of something that's bigger. Scripture often talks about this as being shadows for which there is a future reality. And so I think, for me, my thesis is going to be the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 is a type or a foreshadowing of what's going to happen when Jesus returns. And I think it's very difficult to piece together the things in the book of Revelation and say they happened in AD 70, unless you take a very hyper metaphorical view of the things, like when you get the seal that's open where these scorpion demon things are released, right? Then maybe that was something that happened in 87, right? Yeah, I mean, you could map those things, but so we'll talk about that. So today we're really going to focus on the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So a lot of it's going to be just sort of history, and I find it really, really fascinating. So anyways, that's what kind of look at today. So go ahead and open. Yes?
People that believe that it's already been fulfilled are preterists?
Preterists. That's
how do you spell that?
Preterism. P-R-E-T-E-R-I-S-M? Preterism? Preterists. P-R-E-T-R-E-I-S. And there's also what's called partial preterists, where they believe a lot of the things that happened, but there's still elements that have yet to happen. That's kind of the partial preterism. And frankly, though... No matter what your eschatology is in terms of amillennialism or preterism or premillennialism, they all agree that Christ hasn't come yet, that's still future. So there is one thread that is common to all those various eschatological views, is that Christ is yet to come. But everything else, there's a pretty big difference. So anyway, so I'm going to look at Matthew 24. Now, in church, we're going through Mark 13. And Mark 13 and Matthew 24 parallel each other almost exactly. And there's a few details in Mark that aren't in Matthew. Matthew is by the most detailed. Luke is a little different. Luke 21 is also the same subject. And if you just read them casually, you think, oh, it's just the same, Jesus is talking about the exact same thing. But there are some really significant differences in Luke 21. I believe it was a slightly different sermon that Jesus gave in Luke 21. And some of the differences are kind of important when you start looking at the details. So we'll talk about that as well. But today we're just sort of going to get started in looking at Matthew 24. And can I read my fine print in the dark? That's going to be the question. So I will try. So Matthew 24. So Matthew 24, you realize when we get to this point that the triumphal entry is in Matthew 21. So Jesus is in the middle of his Passion Week, right? He's already gone to Jerusalem. He's told his disciples, hey, I'm going to Jerusalem. I'm going there to be rejected by the chief elders and scribes. I'm going to be beaten and flogged. I'm going to be spit on. They're going to kill me, but I'm going to rise again on the third day, right? And so, in fact, we're just talking about that in Mark 8 in church right now, right? We're just at that point after Peter's confession, and then Peter's confession in Mark is the hinge point in all the synoptic gospels. Before Peter's confession, Jesus speaks about the cross in a very oblique ways, right? He'll say things like, oh, you destroy the temple in 3 days and I'll raise it back up again, right? We know from that he's actually talking about his crucifixion, right? But after Peter's confession, he's very explicit about, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to be rejected, they're going to flog me, they're going to kill me, I'm going to die, I'm going to rise again on the third day. He says it repeatedly after Peter's confession. And so before that point, you're really trying to figure out who Jesus is. That's why when he asked the disciples, Who do people say that I am, right? So people need to make a decision about who Jesus Christ is. And then once you know who Jesus Christ is, then it's his mission to the cross. So at this point, his face was turned towards Jerusalem. He went head on to Jerusalem. He knew he was going to die. So when he says these things, he's in the week that he knows he's going to be crucified and die. And when he says these things. So that's where we find ourselves in Matthew 24. He's at the temple. So he's in Jerusalem for the last time, at least during his first earthly ministry. He's going to come back again someday. And if you look just before, Luke 24, at the end of Luke 23, it says, Jesus is weeping over Jerusalem. He says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. See, your house has left you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Right? So he's talking about, he's been rejected, right? That's the first thing he tells the disciples. He's going there, he's going to be rejected. And he's lamenting over Jerusalem. And so, this is actually a model of Jerusalem. I think it's somewhere in Israel. Did you go to this? Maybe people have actually been there. I don't know what the scale is, but yeah, you can walk around it, right, and look at it. And so this is actually, this would be sort of your view if you're kind of on the northern part of the Mount of Olives, I think, looking west, and you would see the temple here. And so we'll look at this in some detail. So this was magnificent. One thing you don't see is all the gold and silver in this model that was there. So it was a very impressive stature. All the walls and everything were pretty incredible. So, so the history of this is, this goes all the way. Actually, I talk about Abraham here in Genesis 22, but if you go back even earlier in Genesis, you have Melchizedek, that's priest of Salem, right? So this city of Jerusalem goes all the way back to this priest Melchizedek. And I'm going to look at some Josephus in. Josephus goes into detail about him being sort of the first king of Jerusalem. But later on, in Genesis 22, when Abraham goes to sacrifice Isaac, and all that whole event happens, it says that this happened on Mount Moriah. Abraham was going to go to Mount Moriah. But if you go to 2 Chronicles, you'll see that Mount Moriah is actually where the Temple Mount is. So Abraham's faux sacrifice of Isaac actually happened at the same place that Christ was crucified. And that's why the hill was named Jehovah Jireh, the hill that it will be provided on. It's future tense, right? That there's going to be. So this is the same place that the temple was built. And so, as you know, Solomon built the first temple in about 964 BC, and you can read about that in 1 Kings. And then, of course, we've talked about this in great detail. This was finally just burned and razed to the ground by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians in 586 in the final third wave of the siege of by Nebuchadnezzar, which is really, really interesting. We'll find out today that the Romans are going to burn Jerusalem on the exact same month and day that Nebuchadnezzar burned Jerusalem in antiquity. So the first temple was destroyed, was wiped out. And then, of course, you had the Babylonian captivity, which we've been talking about in Daniel. And then finally, there was three waves of exiles that returned back to Jerusalem, and Zerubbabel has been in one of the waves that began. So they began building the second temple, and they built the temple long before the walls in the city were built, right? You got to wait until you get to Nehemiah and the walls in the city get built. But the temple's built first. We call this the Temple of Zerubbabel, and so that was built in about 515 BC. So this is quite a ways after the temple was destroyed, they begin to build the second temple. Right, and you can read about that in Ezra. Now, we'll talk about this a little bit in a minute here, but as you go forward in history, when Rome is now the world power, Judea is a long ways from Rome, right? If you look at a map. I'll show you a map in a minute. But it's a long ways, and so it was a while before the Romans had the Judea region under their thumb. And so one of the things they did is they put Herod the Great. And so Herod the Great improved the temple tremendously and remade a lot of the temple and wanted to make it great. And so the temple was a beautiful thing. So when Christ is at the temple, it's sometimes we call it the Zerubbabel temple, the second temple, or sometimes we call it Herod's temple as well. But this is sort of a piece of Herod's temple, and you could sort of see this is sort of the sanctuary is this inner part. So you can see there's a veil here, and the Holy of Holies are back here, and you can see all these various gates, and we have very detailed descriptions of this. I'm going to try and read some sections from Josephus today, and he describes this in great detail. So he started expanding the temple in about 17 BC. So by the time Christ is on the scene, you're dealing with, you know, Herod the Great was the one who tried to kill Jesus when he was born. But you can see this magnificent temple. And that takes us to Matthew 24. And let me show you a map here. So here's an ancient map of Jerusalem. I don't know how well you can see it, but this here is, you can see it says Moriah. This here is the Temple Mount, which is on the eastern edge of Jerusalem. And down here, this area is usually called the City of David. This is sort of the original city was down here. This is the upper city and the lower city. So all the rich and the elites lived up here in the upper city, and that's where Caiaphas and all the big wigs all lived in the upper city, and then more of the common people lived down in the lower city. But you can see that, on the whole southern part of this is protected by a deep valley. Jerusalem's up on a hill, and there's these valleys. So over on the left, you have the Gihon Valley. Here in the bottom, you have the Hinnom Valley. And to the east, you have the Kidron Valley. And on the other side of the Kidron Valley, you have the Mount of Olives. So kind of the main point of the Mount of Olives is here, but this kind of whole area here is sort of called the Mount of Olives. So you can look across the Mount of Olives, and you can see the temple from the Mount of Olives.
Does that map show where Jesus was crucified?
We don't know for sure, but Golgotha is, we think it's somewhere out in this area. So you can see there are multiple walls, right? So we're going to talk about, this is going to be sort of this first walls that were built here. And then the city later on expanded, and there was a second wall. And then the time of Herod expanded again into this new city, and there's a third wall that goes around here. But my understanding is Golgotha is up here somewhere. So that's where Christ. Remember, according to Hebrews, he was outside the gates, right? So he was outside at least the second wall at that point, but inside the third. So Herod fortified all these walls, thickened them, raised them up another 9 meters, which I think made the Romans kind of like, what are you doing? You know, like, why are you making this so protective, right? So anyway, so Jesus, is going to often make this trip between the Mount of Olives and the temple. And so you can look to the west as you're on the Mount of Olives, and you can see the Temple Mount, which would have been impressive. I think this is where the Garden of Gethsemane is, and this is where Mary and Lazarus' place was, so Bethany and stuff. So this was a trip that Jesus often made over there. Yeah?
Does that show where the Roman fortress was?
Well, which one?
Antonia?
Antonia? Say that again?
At the time that Jesus was there.
Or where they had their garrisons and stuff? I'm not sure. There's a bit, you're going to see here, there's this thing called the Fortress of Antonia that's here. We're going to talk about that a lot, and that's where the Jews kind of held up during the siege. So you're going to, if I go back one, you can, or back two, you can see this big fortress here. We'll mention this. That's the Fortress of Antonia. And that was designed as a defense mechanism to, and the Romans are going to have to, that's going to get burned to the ground and destroyed, and so they can get into the temple. And they eventually have to destroy all these colonnades and this entire wall before they get in here. But yeah, this is the Fortress of Antonia. So I don't know, at the time of Jesus, where all the Roman garrisons and stuff were at that time. But this, by the time you get to the events of the destruction of Jerusalem, they will have kicked out the Romans, right? That's why the Romans are coming back to destroy them. So that maybe that was the place. No, I know it's not shown in here, but there was Antiochus actually. There was another fortress that he built, that Antiochus had built here, that was next to the temple. I don't know if it was destroyed by the time Herod came around. Probably was. So we'll mention this. That's an important fort that you see there. And it looks like a fort, right? So, yeah. So that's kind of the map of Jerusalem. And we're going to see the Romans are going to attack from the west, the north, and the east. And there's a good reason why you don't attack from down here, because it's difficult, right? This is a very, you know, you got a valley and a cross. But you're going to see that there's going to be a lot of sallies and skirmishes through the Kidron Valley. So anyway. So that's what the temple looked like, and that's what Jesus sees. So in Matthew 24, it says Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. And you can see this also in Mark 13. And they're amazed at this incredible edifice. It was beautiful. And the walls, I dare say the number. They're incredibly thick walls and ordained with all kinds of gold. It would have been an amazing sight to see. You can see kind of what the height of a person would be. These are the doors. These are the various gates going in. And you can see, you know, these steps. You can see it was a massive structure. And the whole temple, that's just this part, right? Then there's the whole Temple Mount and these amazing walls. And so the disciples are amazed. Jesus, look at this building. Isn't this impressive? That's what they're saying. And they're amazed that just something like this could even be built. So But he says he answered them. In verse 2, he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." So Jesus here is predicting that this is telling them, is foretelling them that this, every stone here is going to be cast down. This is going to be decimated. This is going to be wiped out. Which is amazing because, as I'll talk about later, the Romans with their siege engines, these stones were so large, their siege engines, they didn't have engines big enough to actually knock down these stones. It took a long time, and because of the melting of all the gold when it gets caught fire, they get the gold. They've got to wipe all the stones out. And so you're going to see this building's going to get wiped out. But it would have been an amazing prophecy at the time to think that a structure like this could be completely decimated. But that's what Jesus says. So this is the week of his crucifixion. So depending on when you date the crucifixion, we're somewhere between AD 30 and AD 33. I think AD 32, but I'm in the minority. Some people say either AD 33 or AD 30, or some say 31. So So the destruction of Jerusalem, what I'm going to talk about, the siege of Jerusalem, is going to happen in AD 70. So we got to fast forward like 38 years before we get to the point what Christ is talking about. So that's what he introduces here. And clearly he's talking about the events that we're going to discuss today. And then so today's going to be kind of a history lesson. I want to go over the siege of Jerusalem and the things that happened, and I'll try to read some stuff from Josephus. If you really want to read this in some detail, you can get a copy of Josephus, and it's great detail of all the Roman legions. So I'm going to give you just the highlights of kind of what happened and how the city was destroyed. But you can read this in great detail from Josephus, who was a Roman/Jewish historian from this time. So that's kind of the goal. So then I want to use that when we talk about the rest of the Olivet Discourse. We can sort of use that as context. And now you'll have an understanding of where sort of preterism comes from, because you'll be able to map, well, some of the things that Jesus says later, how does that map to what happened actually historically? And you'll see there's some matches and some mismatches, and we'll talk about that. Okay. So I'm going to jump into this. Now, the best way to learn about this is to actually get Josephus and read the story. But there is this fantastic YouTube channel called Invicta, where they take a game engine for making video games, and they use it to recreate the entire siege of Jerusalem. It is fantastic. So just if you go to YouTube and go to Invicta, they've got parts 1, 2, and 3. They haven't made the fourth one yet. So everyone's like biting, like, get the fourth one out. And so you could actually, I don't play a lot of video games, but there's a whole bunch of video games that are based on the same engine. So they actually use it to tell history stories. You can actually get the siege at Masada, which happens several years after this, which the Romans had to build this giant ramp up to get to the Jews at Masada, but they do this with this game engine, and it is really incredible. I'll warn you, it's a little bit of game violence in it, so you know it shows they like to show blood spurting and things, you know. But it's really amazing just from a historical point of view, and it's very fascinating. If you've got like older kids, you want to have them learn a little history, you can have them watch this, because it's pretty exciting. So. All right, so let's kind of go back in history a little bit. So you can see Judea is down here on the very, very, outskirts of the Roman world. Now, you can't even see Rome, you can see just the tip of the boot of Italy, but Rome's up here somewhere. So you can see there's quite an outpost. Judea would have been a distant outpost at that time. And the Romans first took control of Judea clear back in 63 BC under this, what I kind of consider the first Caesar is Pompey, right? Because after Pompey, then you have Julius Caesar, who was murdered, and then you have the first emperor, Caesar Augustus, and then Caesar Augustus, I think then you had Caligula after him? I don't know. I can't remember the exact sequence. But the Romans first took control of Judea clear back in 63 BC, and they controlled the city, and they left garrisons there. So the Romans had it under thumb. But there was a lot of turbulence in the region. There was a lot of infighting, right? The Jews did not like being under the thumbs of the Romans, and there were all kinds of civil war and battles that were going on, and there was a lot of unrest. And you can see Pilate's fear during Jesus' time. That's exactly what he's worried about, is there's going to be some sort of uprising, and he's afraid Jesus is going to cause this uprising. That's why he was so willing to crucify Jesus, because that's one of his jobs, is to keep any uprisings from happening. So there was an extremely unstable region. So the Romans had to leave garrisons there, dating all the way back to 63 BC. Fast forward to 66 AD, Jerusalem was plundered, and a bunch of Jews were killed. Then by this time, Nero is the emperor at this time. So he sends his procurator Florus in there, and the history books can give you all the details on this, but he actually went in and plundered in Jerusalem and killed a lot of Jews. And this was really a bad idea for Rome, because this really fermented the uprising against Rome. So later on, the Jewish rebels kicked them out and took over, And they fought off the Romans. The Romans didn't have enough garrisons there, and the Jews were extremely zealous for their city. A lot of them were, and they kicked the Romans out clear back in 66 A.D. So this is after the time of Christ, right? But this is only, we're looking 4 years between that point and the Romans are coming back, right? They've made the Romans mad, and they're going to keep this city under their thumb. And the Romans had an impressive war machine. So between 66 AD and 70 AD is this time period. They're going to prepare for war to sack Jerusalem. So, and by this point, the Romans have conquered Britain. I mean, that's how far north. And they've Northern Africa, they've dominated Northern Africa. And I forget the name of the big city up here.
Benghazi now?
Yeah, but what's its ancient name, though? No, Alexandria is down here. I'm thinking of Carthage. Yeah, the Battle of Carthage, right? That's here. In fact, you're going to find to prepare for the Judean siege of Jerusalem, the armies are going to go to Alexandria to prepare for their battle. So, which is amazing to me. How did they? I mean, they didn't have a Boeing 737 to get from here to here, right? How would you get all? You'd have to go through Turkey and down, or take a ship across to get to here to prepare your battle. But that's where they're going to prepare to attack. So and then near at this point in 67 AD, Nero is the current Roman emperor, and he sends his Roman general named Vespasian. And Vespasian had a son named Titus, and on a campaign to occupy the entire region. So the Romans got to get the entire region under their thumb. So Vespasian and his son Titus are the generals that he sends. And so they go down. Actually, at this point they're not in Alexandria. The Romans, they come down and they start in Galilee and they start working their way south. They go through Galilee and down through Samaria. Then they go through Caesarea down on the coast. And then they wipe out Idumea to the south. And they're getting ready to go to Jerusalem. But in the middle of this, Nero commits suicide and dies. And so there's a whole bunch of strife inside of Rome to see who's going to be the next Caesar. And there was a sequence of Caesars that were briefly Caesar, but eventually Vespasian becomes the next Caesar, the next emperor of Rome. He's the main general. And this happens a lot in the ancient world where the generals, the military leaders actually are the ones that ascend to the throne. And so he does that. So there's a big power. And so he bids for power and this big civil war within Rome. And in 69 AD, he actually becomes Caesar, and he has to return to Rome because he's Caesar now. But he's going to leave Titus, his son Titus, behind because he trusts him. And so it's going to be Titus's job to put an end to the Jewish uprising and begin the siege. Now, the historian Josephus, at this point, he was that first wave that went in there. Josephus was a Jew, and he was part of that, but he was captured, and he basically told Vespasian that he was going to be emperor, and that kind of gave him favor in the eyes of Vespasian. So he took Josephus and made him a slave, and eventually freed him. And then now, at that point, Josephus actually becomes a historian for the Romans. So he's going to travel with Titus, and he's going to travel with the Romans. And so they kind of think, the Jews think of him as a traitor now, because now he was a Jew, now he's joined over on the Roman side, right? So, and in fact, Josephus takes on the name Flavius, which the Flavian dynasty began with Vespasian, and then later on, Titus, after this, is going to become the next Caesar. So Josephus actually takes on this name. So he's the traveling historian. So he's the one recording all these things. And of course, it's always a little bit favorable in the eyes of Rome, and especially in the eyes of Titus, as you'll see. But he also has a heart for Jerusalem as well. So he does record the bravery of a lot of things that happen, although he tends not to treat the Jews too well, and then there might be reason for that. So anyway, so Titus will become the next emperor after this whole event. So Josephus gives us a really detailed history about all this. So the campaign begins in 70 AD. So they're going to assemble clear down in Alexandria, which is in Egypt. That's where they decide to get together, and they're going to decide how they're going to defeat Jerusalem. And he actually has four different legions with him, Yeah, and these are well-known legions, evidently. There's the 5th Legion, which was called the Macedonian Legion, which, you know, Macedonian, that's where Alexander the Great was from, so they got a legion named after him. And then there was two legions, the 12th and the 15th, the Fulminate and the Apollinaris legions. And these are going to be the legions that are going to be read specifically by Titus. And then there's the tenth legion, which are going to be the Fratensis. And you're going to see eventually they're going to attack Jerusalem from the west and from the east and from the north. They don't attack from the south here. So they think in total, plus all the locals that they gathered up around there that didn't like Jerusalem either. So they had about 60,000 soldiers by the time they are going up to Jerusalem to attack it. And they've got cavalry, and they gather about 20,000 local troops, got about 3,000 cavalry, close to 16,000 infantry, and these are the numbers that Josephus gets. So it's a pretty powerful force of about 60,000 men that includes siege engines, battering rams, and cavalry, and all the different armory that the Romans have. At this point, the Jews have actually, because of the previous war when they kicked the Romans out, they had built up their own armory of old equipment. So they're pretty prepared for battle, except they had other problems. So Josephus is actually along for the ride. So Josephus is down in Alexandria and travels with Titus and his army. So Vespasian's gone now. Vespasian, his dad, is Caesar. Titus is the son. In fact, if you read this, Joseph calls Titus Caesar as well, because it's kind of this father-son relationship as well. And so he's accompanying Titus. And so now they got to make the trip all the way from Egypt, and they're going to go to Jerusalem, and they're going to come up on the coast, and they're going to go to Caesarea. So that's the next, they're going to go to Caesarea, and then they're going to cut in and battle into Jerusalem. Let's see, I might go back and read some stuff from Josephus. We'll see how the time goes here. So Jerusalem was pretty, so we already talked a little bit about this. So in Jerusalem, you can see the Temple Mount. So we had sort of this, the original city of David was this sort of this lower area. But you can see you have the upper city, that's where all the elites lived, and you had the lower city where kind of all the common masses lived. And then you have the first expansion here. So this all is the first wall. So this wall that goes here around the temple, all around here, that's the first wall. And then it was expanded at some point in history, and then they made a second wall there. And then in the time of Herod, there was another expansion, an area called the New City, and they had built the third wall there. So that's kind of the situation. And Herod had increased all the walls' heights by 9 meters and thickened them. These are incredibly thick walls, especially at the temple. These are massive stones that the whole temple is built on. So that's the situation. So, and they intentionally designed all the roads to not be straight, so that you would make all the roads crooked so that it's hard for defenders to get in, right? And it's easy to defend, so there's no straight. And you can see castles of old, right? In old cities like this, they never made straight roads because it's too easy to go in and rampage the city if you got straight roads. So there's a lot. But they also had a lot of underground mines and sewer systems and all. I mean, remember how David got in through a water shaft? But they had lots of water shafts. And even under the time of Herod the Great, clear under King Hezekiah, to protect themselves from the Assyrians, had built ways to divert water and had cisterns and things underneath and all kinds of ways where you could have surprise attacks. And I mean, so Jerusalem was really designed to be well defended. It was on a hill. It was easy to, even in the time of David, right? The people that had the city that occupied the city at that time, they mocked David because they said, there's no way you can take this city because it's so easy to defend. So, but the Romans did not expect them to put up as much a fight. You know, the Romans, they have by far the most advanced army in the world by this point. And Jerusalem, there's really about 20,000 troops. And it was sort of you'll read about this, you'll read about two guys, one Simon and one John, and these groups didn't get along. They didn't, normally they would be enemies of each other, but because now the Romans are coming, they kind of had a confederacy to work together. And so you can see John sort of took the area around the temple, and Simon with the elites, he defended this area, and he had all, and so you didn't have to defend this area as well, so John's going to defend the temple area, and Simon's going to defend the upper part of the city. So they're the kind of the main groups of troops, and they're very fractured. There's a lot of civil war and strife between them, and one of the sad things from their perspective is they had a good food supply. They could have withstood a siege of years, but from their infighting, they actually burned a lot of each other's grain and stuff, so they ran out of food. So they kind of, you know, and in fact, a lot of them did it intentionally because they wanted to make them desperate, so they wanted to fight the Romans, and so you're going to, starvation's going to become a really big deal, and so their food supplies are gone. Their water supplies are really, really good, even because of what Hezekiah did. There's all kinds of springs and stuff that they rerouted, so they've got a good water supply, but it's food that's going to be scarce, and you'll see what the Romans do. But they were pretty well armed. They had slings, bows, javelins, spears, and clubs. And you're going to see later that they actually had they had artillery where they could fire bolts, and they had some stone throwers and stuff, you know. So they, especially Simon, had a lot of this stuff. So. And they had all the stuff they gathered up from the last Roman defeat. Now, normally in the city there would be about 100,000 people. But what makes this extraordinarily bad is there was people coming for the Passover. And the city of Jerusalem swells during the time of the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so Josephus claims that that's going to be 1.1 million people that are going to die, according to Josephus. A lot of people doubt those numbers, but Josephus swears by these numbers. And there's going to be 90,000 people taken in slaves, and 1.1 million people are going to die, and largely because of Passover time. So the Romans attacked just a few days after Passover, and so the city is just swelling with people, or is it 4 days before? But anyway, so, and a lot of these people, they don't know how to fight, right? They don't, and so they're just going to be slaughtered. And John here actually takes over the temple. He goes in like he's going to sacrifice, but he hides weapons under, and he takes over the temple because he knows he's going to get prepared for war and what's happening. And so the ritual sacrifices are still going on. They're still sacrificing rams. Eventually, they're going to run out of rams, and the sacrifices are going to stop. But anyway, so that's sort of the situation that you have at this point. So here I talk about food stores. Simon had his food stores, and there was other food stores, and most of these were raided and destroyed. They had water, and it's really sad because had they kept those food stores, they could have withstood a Roman siege for a lot longer, at least in terms of starvation. Starvation is one of the reasons that really caused their defeat, because people were weak. And yeah, so Rome's going to engage what's called siege warfare. They're going to come with battering rams, they're going to come with all kinds of artillery, and they're going to come with these giant siege engines. Like, what I tell my kids, if you've seen Return of the King, when they go against, Minas Tirith at the end, right? Those giant, all the battering rams, that's very similar, and I'll show you kind of some pictures. So they had these giant siege towers that they would build that were extremely high and covered with iron that you couldn't set on fire, and they'd put against the city, and they would use them. So anyway, so it's really crazy. So that's kind of the situation. So this sort of shows you the different. So they had plenty of water, but very little food by the time this begins to happen, and that's very problematic at this point. So the Romans start surrounding the city. As I showed you, you saw the different legions that were surrounded, that were on the east and the north and the west. And so, to much surprise, the Jewish soldiers would form little raids and to go out and try to attack the Romans in their camps. And that was sort of a surprise. In fact, at one point, Titus went up to inspect the walls, and he didn't even have his helmet or his shield or anything, and he was just inspecting the walls, and some of the Jewish rebels came out and attacked him, and he fought a lot of them off and protected his men. Titus records that he saved his legion by himself at least twice. Now, of course, I don't know how much, he's glorifying Titus. But so the Jews, now think about this. This is the Kidron Valley, and this is the Mount of Olives here, right? So when they attacked, they'd have to come across the Kidron Valley to attack the Roman camp. And the Romans initially didn't expect them to do this. They expect them to hole up. And by the way, at this point, there's a lot of debris and trees and things out here at the early part of the siege. And so they could hide behind things. But after this, the Romans wiped out all the trees, removed all the debris, and set everything up so they could siege and so that they couldn't surprise attack. But the Jews would have all these surprise attacks as the Romans set up their camps. Now, Titus decided to first attack from the west. So he had his 5th Legion and his 12th and 15th Legion. So he's first going to attack on the western wall, which is up here. So this is going to be his first attack. So what he starts with, he builds up a camp out here. And actually, at this time, he actually builds up walls around his camp so they would protect his legions from the Jews trying to get to him. And so the things they start with are just the kind of the things like we did in World War II. So if you're going to storm the beach, the first thing you do is you use artillery, right? You're going to go bomb the heck out of the place. And that's exactly what they did. Is they had these artillery, these giant machines that would fire, giant, spears and arrows and rocks, and they had rock throwing machines, and they just would start pummeling the whole area here. So that's kind of how they began. They started, and then slowly they're going to clear out the area, and they're going to bring in their battering rams, and then after the battering rams, the idea is then they're going to bring in their giant siege towers. They're going to put them up against the wall, and that's kind of, and they're going to have to build up ramps. So they're gonna take timber, which early on there was quite a bit of timber, but between having to build and repair all their siege engines and crucifying people, about 500 a day, they were running out of wood. So they were running out of wood, and so it was really hard to build all these siege ramps because they've just decimated the entire area with all the wood that was going out. So they're going to build their siege ramps eventually and work up here. But much to their surprise, the Jews actually put up a pretty good fight. So they would actually come out and attack them, but they would come out and have these various sallies against the Romans, and the Romans would fight them back. And the Romans had cavalry, and cavalry is a huge advantage out in the field. And so they made good use of their cavalry to protect them. But the Jews had stone throwers and things like that, and they would harass them, so you couldn't get very close to the wall. So eventually, they bring up their battering rams, and these battering rams are just hammering against the wall, this very thick wall. And that was the moment in time that really, imagine being inside the city, you could hear the vibrations of this battering ram. Have you ever been like where they're using pile drivers, where they're buildings, and you could just the whole ground shake? So you imagine the whole city is being shaken by these battering rams on the western wall. And that really solidified, hey, it's basically, we're going to die, we're going to fight, we're going to die, or we're going to win. There's no choice. So they were very determined to win. And this is a great picture from the game where they're bringing up these giant siege towers. Right? And they're eventually going to get them up to the wall. But the closer they get to the wall, there's a lot of danger. That's why these things were covered with iron and with the kinds of material that wouldn't burn. They didn't want these things to be set on fire. They designed them so they were very difficult to overturn. So those are the kind of the machinery. Imagine that Romans had to build these things, and an incredible amount of work to do this. So yeah, so finally on the 15th, so it took them 2 weeks. By the 15th day of the siege, they'd actually broke through the wall. By the way, so this starts in April, maybe late March, April. And it's going to go all the way to August. So they'll finally break through in August. They finally completely control the city by September the next year. So this is several months. So about the 15th day, they break through the third wall. Remember, that was the wall that Herod built around the new city that was up in it. So they broke through that. So the Jews withdrew inside the second wall. They left that area. And so the Romans actually got in, and they could build up their camps inside that new city area. So that's where they built their camps. Within the next 4 days, they'd actually brought their siege engine and breached the second wall, the Jews were really tricky. So they went in, and they the Romans started marching in, and they only breached one narrow area of the wall. And the Romans went in, and the city seemed empty. So the Romans just start piling in, and but the Jews were all in hiding. And they had all their bolt throwers and stuff, and so when the Romans had exposed their flanks, the Jews came up and attacked, and it forced the, and a lot of the Romans died because there was only one narrow way to get out. And so a lot of so the Romans were really defeated. Of course, that just made them madder, so they came back. So they end up, instead of just tearing down part of the wall, they tore down the entire, almost the entire second wall. They tore down so they could have a wide area to go into. So by that point, all the Jewish troops had retreated inside the first wall. So you had John in the temple and the fortress of Antonia, and then you had Simon in the upper city behind the first wall. So those were, the first wall was really designed for a defensive position, and there was only a few spots of attack to go to, and they were pretty well armed at this point. Simon, like I said, I think he had something like 300 bolt throwers and like 40 stone throwers he had collected over the years. And there was all kinds of places that they could have archers on the walls to shoot the Romans. So they were going to hole up there to sort of survive this particular siege. Yeah, so you have Simon's going to hold up the first wall. John's going to be holding up the temple area and this area called the Antonia Fortress here. So that's now the defense. So now the Romans have they're camped up here in the new city. They've broken down the wall, the second wall, and they're occupy this region. So they're going to have two points of attack. They're going to attack the fortress of Antonia, and they're going to the second wall here. So they're going to bring troops in here, and so there's going to be the two points of attack to try to break through the second wall at this point. So again, they're building ramps. These walls, when they attack, they'd build up ramps so that would go up to the, so they could, their forces could go up to the top of the wall. The Jews had quite a bit of ammunition. Now, I'm really abbreviating this. This there's a lot of fascinating details, and if we have time, maybe I'll go back and read some of the details. Some of the details are very fascinating, some of them are very horrific. But they eventually moved their battering rams in and began to siege. So this is when the real battle kind of started to take off at this point. Now, just something sort of fascinating. It's like I mentioned, there's all these mines and sewer systems underneath the city. Well, it turns out they had a mine shaft that went underneath the Antonia Fortress. And so there was a group of Jewish rebels that went in and into this, and they dug it out more, and they filled it with bitumen and pitch and dry wood, and they set it on fire. So they went down in here. Now the Romans at this point, right, they're bringing their siege engines in and their battering rams to break down the fortress. And so they're underneath them, and they're going to set that on fire. And what that's going to do is eventually this is going to cause this to collapse, and with all the bitumen and wood, it's going to set this whole area on fire out here. And they're going to succeed in actually getting these siege engines and these siege towers on fire. And they're going to get the battering rams. But it's also going to eventually, you're going to see later on, part of the fortress is actually going to be are going to be destroyed as well. Yeah, so the earth eventually gives way and engulfs all their siege engines. So that was one of their plans. So the Jewish soldiers are actually pretty successful in knocking them back. But the Romans again are just going to regroup. I mean, they're going to take the city. They're determined to take the city, and they're going to regroup. And you're getting here. You're starting to get towards summertime. So now things are getting hot, and like I said, building material is getting scarce. The Romans are running out of wood to crucify people with, and to because constantly people are going out to try to escape the city. And you're going to see in the next slide. The Romans build with this what's called the Wall of Circumvallation. So they're going to build an 8-kilometer wall around the city to make sure nobody gets out. And if they catch you, you die. and you're going to be crucified, and you're going to be made a spectacle of. And this is, they're running out of wood. They're crucifying about five, according to Josephus, they're crucifying about 500 people a day doing this. It's even worse because a lot of the people that are running out would hide gems and gold, would eat them, right? And so the Romans would inviscerate them to get the money out and the gold and everything. It's horrific, right? But part of this is they're going to starve them out. So Josephus knows, he's an emissary for them, and he goes in, and many times Titus wants them to surrender. He's always sending Josephus in to surrender. And they're determined. They said, God's never going to let you take our temple and our city, and he can't get them to surrender. Titus doesn't want to, you know, decimate the city. He just wants to conquer it, but they're not going to. So he takes his legions and he makes a contest out of it. Who can build their section of the wall fastest? And so they build this entire 8-kilometer wall in about 4 or 5 days around the whole city. And they're going to starve them out. That's kind of part of the idea. And they're going to make sure nobody escapes. Nobody's going to escape this particular region. So now things really get serious. Things are about to really get bad. Starvation begins. There's this horrible story that Josephus records about mothers eating their children, and people are battling each other, trying to, you know, they're boiling hay, they're eating dogs, whatever they can. I mean, they're starving, and people don't have food. And so then the whole Kidron Valley and Hinnom Valley here is, he numbers all the corpses. It is very, very, very bloody, much like what talks about in Revelation about the blood filling up to the horse's leg.
Sounds like Amos.
Yeah. It's horrific. But things have only started. Things are about to get worse. So I gave some details here that I already mentioned here. So that's the wall. So the Romans are gonna make sure nobody gets out. They're going to starve them out, and they're going to make sure that they're not getting supplies. No one can get food or supplies. So that's the wall that they built. And you can see they go right through the upper city, or not the upper city, before the new city. You can see the wall goes right through there. So it's pretty impressive that they build this wall, but they're running out of timber fast. Now, during this time, there were some heavy rains, and when the Romans start moving their heavy siege engines in and it starts to rain, the fact that this tunnel that the Jews, the rebels, had built, the ground started to give way, and part of the first part of the Antonia fortress crumbled off and fell off. And so the Jews quickly scrambled and built another wall, so that they could defend. Of course, this is the temple, right? This is the thing they have to defend. So they're going to build another wall to keep the Romans from getting in there. So, and these battles go on into the night, and it gets, yeah, it's pretty extreme. So they're going to build more siege ramps. Make a long story short, and they start building a siege ramp against the northwest corner of the temple. So that's the first route that the Romans are going to get in to. Now, the Jews at this point, since this half is destroyed, they're going to try to separate, because there's a huge, massive wall between the Antonia Fortress and the Temple Mount area here. There's a massive wall, and they know the Romans can kind of hide in here, so they're going to try to separate this area and destroy it more so they can defend it during this time period. I'm making a long story really short. So one of the things, moving along a little bit, along the portico on the other side, on the northwest side, at one point, the Jews had set a trap. It looked to the Romans that it wasn't defended at all. So the Romans, so Titus is always trying to make, you know, whenever there's good fortune, they try to take advantage of that right away. So they have a whole bunch of Roman soldiers go in. But what the Jews had done is they had packed wood and bitumen and pitch and everything along here, and they set the whole thing on fire. So they cut the Romans up in this conflagration, and so that wall is all set on fire. And so anyway, like a long story short, the Romans are still not giving up, and the Jews refuse to give up their temple. And this continues on. So at one point they break through a corner of the temple wall and they get in, but again, it's kind of a chokehold. They get knocked back. The Jews actually set the fires first. They start burning setting fires to burn the Antonia fortress because they want it separated from the wall so they could use that wall as a defense. But the Romans bring up all their battering rams and eventually knock down that whole northern wall of the temple so that they can get in. So. And up to this point, the priests were still sacrificing rams in the temple, and they still, but they ran out of rams. So all the sacrificing had stopped at this point, which was kind of a bad omen at this point. I'll talk about this. There's a lot actually that happens at this point. So the Jews are actually the first ones that start setting things on fire. Then the Romans start setting stuff on fire, and stuff starts to burn. Now Titus doesn't want to burn the temple. He wants to save the temple. Now he initially starts fire because he's losing too many men. When they build these siege works, the Jews were able to protect it by pushing over the siege work, and so he decides, well, I'm just going to build a fire there, but he's going to later want to put it out. But his men are so mad that it's apparent that they don't even listen to Titus now. They're just going to burn. They're going to burn everything. And so, at this point all the metal and gold is being melted. And Titus wants to put out the fire, but he can't for a couple reasons. The fire is too big, and also his men they're so mad. They don't listen to him. So they're in the height of passion. They are so mad that they don't surrender, and their men are of course dying. So his enraged troops continue to burn it down. And eventually, at one point, one of the Roman soldiers throws a flame inside the sanctuary, and then the whole sanctuary starts to burn. And he says, being every one mass of flame, yet the stream of blood was more copious than the flame. So there was so much blood, and the corpses were piled up that they were just sliding down, and it was just horrific beyond horrific. So you can imagine why some people are preterists, because what they're describing is absolutely I'm kind of taming it a little bit, but that's one of the problems they have, is they're trying constantly to get corpses out of the city all the time. The Jews don't want corpses, and so they're constantly bringing corpses, putting them down in the Hinnom and in the valley and stuff. But there's just beyond too many corpses, and there's so much blood. The blood is actually putting out a lot of the fires. It's so bad. So eventually, the Romans carry in their standards into the sanctuary, and they eventually take over the temple. Now, a couple things happen here that are interesting is there were false prophets that were telling the Jews that they just hang on, that they'll be able to defeat the Romans. So a lot of things that Christ talks about, there's going to be false prophets. Well, there were false prophets there that were telling, they were wrong because they got slaughtered, and actually that made the slaughter worse because they refused to surrender because they were listening to this false prophet. But also, a lot of people think that the Romans sacrificed to their god in the temple. In reality, they went and sacrificed to their gods out at the east gate. So the Romans set up their standards out on the east gate. They didn't actually go into the temple. But if people that have a preterist point of view, they would say this is the point at which the abomination was in the temple. But the Romans never got in there. Titus never went in there. They hauled off all the gold and everything, but so the temple at this point is consumed by fire, and this is what I talk about, the false prophet. Come on, I'm not going to the next page. Why are you not going? I don't know why my... Talk to me. I've lost communication. I'm stuck on this slide. Okay. All right. Well, anyway. So by the time August runs around, by early August, the Romans have sacked the entire city. The temple's been burned to the ground. And one of the reasons when Jesus says all the stones are going to be knocked down is evidently a lot of the precious metal was burned and melted down into the stones, and they wanted to get that stuff. So what do? You start knocking down all the stones so you could strip all the gold that's fell out of there. So pretty much everyone in Jerusalem is made a prisoner. Josephus says there was 97,000 prisoners that were taken. And anyone that was armed, or if you're old or feeble, you were put to death. So he records 1.1 million died due to the large crowd that was trapped during the Passover time. So we can read these if we have time. And the Romans began to burn the rest of the city, the quarters of the city. But Titus eventually ordered the entire city and the temple to just be razed to the ground to fulfill the things that Jesus mentioned about the temple being burned at that point. So anyway, I know this is kind of a quick history of what happened, but I want you to have this kind of idea in context. And next time we look at this, or I'll read some sections as we start going through Matthew 24, and we'll read some of the sections that maybe someone with a preterist view might leverage to say, hey, look, this is what Jesus was talking about. But my thesis is going to be that these were just foreshadowing of what it's going to be like before Jesus returns and the tribulation. Remember, Jesus is going to say, this is going to be the great tribulation. It's going to be as Daniel says in Daniel 12, this is going to be the worst time, the worst kind of tribulation that's ever existed before and after. Now, if you were a citizen of Jerusalem at this time, it would have been horrific. In fact, the worst part of the whole thing was the starvation that happened. It was even worse than, so the starvation was, they people decided that was the worst way of all the ways to die. So anyway, so I just want you to get kind of a historical understanding of what Jesus mentions and how it happened and how the Romans came to bear upon them. There were some Jews that escaped to Masada, and the Romans are going to go destroy Masada in a few years after this. But at this point, now this is the first Jewish war. There's actually a second Jewish war and a third Jewish war. There's going to be a revolt in about 120 AD, something like that. There's another guy that claims to be Messiah, and he rallies his troop, but the Romans come and wipe him out. And then there's a point where, at this point, you enter what's called the diaspora, where the Jews are just going to be spread all over now because their city lays in ruin, their temples have been ruined, and there's no temple there to this very day, right? So we're still under the, no temple's been rebuilt. So Ezekiel talks about this idea of a third temple. There may be plans, it seems, to be in place to build a third temple. But there clearly must be a temple that must be built in the time that when Christ comes, because we know the temple is going to be desecrated once again. And some of these are going to foreshadow something that's going to happen during the tribulation period as well. So anyway, so I spared you a lot of the horror. If you want to read in detail, pick up a copy of Josephus. If you read through, books 5 and 6 of the Jewish war, the Wars of the Jews, that's where almost all the information that I gave you today. He goes into great detail about who the legions are and exactly what happens. It's a fascinating read for sure, especially if you're fascinated by ancient history and how did Rome carry out these kind of siege engines and the details of how they did things. It's pretty fascinating. So that's kind of my introduction to Matthew 24. So now my goal is to take you through Matthew 24 and look at the times that I believe foreshadow the time just before he returns again. And there's going to be a desecration of the temple, and there's going to be this time called the Great Tribulation. And it's going to be horrific, for which this is going to be a foreshadowing of the horrors that will happen just before Christ returns and stuff. So, and actually, it goes into Matthew 25 as well. So in Matthew 25, you're going to get the 10 virgins, and you're going to get into the separation of the sheep and the goats. And these are all things, I think, that happened as you enter in the millennial kingdom for that. So anyway, we'll eventually in church get to Mark 13. You're going to see sort of the same thing told. Look at Luke 21. And there's going to be some really key differences between Luke 21. In Matthew, Jesus says, watch for the abomination of desolation. When you see that, flee. Luke 21, that's not what he says. He says, when you see the armies surround the city, flee. Right? It's a little different. Why is that different? What's the significance there? And what is Jesus saying in the context of what's happening there? So anyway, so I don't know. If you like history, this stuff is sort of fascinating. Check out those YouTube videos if you want to just see a sort of a kind of a computer game animation of this thing happen. I'm hoping they come out with the fourth video. They haven't. It's been like a year and a half, and they haven't come out with the fourth video yet. So that's all we looked at, three verses today. And then, any comments on that? So kind of cheer up your day. So it's interesting because we're entering this time period right now, and so we'll be looking, and Jesus is during the Passion Week when he's revealing these things to his disciples. In one case, he's to the crowd; in one case, he's to his inner circle, telling them what's going to happen. So by the way, we've got fragments of the gospel that predate AD 70, and so Jesus is establishing himself as a prophet because. This is exactly the things about the temple being raised to the ground seem like a pretty amazing prophecy, but it's actually what happened. So anyway, we'll talk some more about that. So go ahead and if you want, go ahead and read Matthew 24 and Mark 13, Luke 21, and we'll spend a little while in there. And we'll eventually work our way through Thessalonians and 1 Corinthians 15 and eventually work our way back to Revelation. So one thing we haven't talked about is this idea of a rapture event, right? That's something I want to spend some time on. And so anyway, I'll leave it at that for now. So, sure. All right. We'll see you next week.